end tonight. Perhaps there was a running board where she could rest underneath, a platform elevated just a couple of inches off the dampish ground. She peered and moved forward.
"And where do you think you're going?"
A Munchkinlander? No, a dwarf stood in her way. He had a cudgel in one hand and was thwacking it into the thick leathery palm of his other hand.
"Going to sleep when I can," she said. "So you're the dwarf, and this is the thing Averick talked about." "The clock of the time dragon," he said. "Open for business tomorrow night, and not until."
"I'll be dead and gone by tomorrow night," she said.
"No, you won't," he answered.
"Well, gone, anyway." She looked at it and straightened up. Then something came back to her. "I wonder how you knew Yackel," she said.
"Oh, Yackel," he said. "Who doesn't know Yackel? Not such a surprise."
"Was she killed today?" said the witch. "By any chance?"
"No chance," he answered.
"Who are you?"
She was afraid, suddenly, after all this headiness of sorrow and violence.
"Oh, the least significant little one," he said.
"Who do you work for?"
"Who haven't I worked for?" said the dwarf. "The devil is a very big angel, but a very little man. But I have no name in this world, so don't bother with me."
"I'm drunk and disorderly," she said, "and I cannot take any more riddles. I killed someone today. I can kill you, too."
"You didn't kill her. She was already dead," said the dwarf calmly. "And you can't kill me, for I'm immortal. But you try very hard at life, and so I will tell you this. I am the guardian of the book, and I was brought to this dreaded, forsaken land to watch over the book's history, to keep it from getting back to where it comes from. I am not good, I am not bad, but I am locked here, condemned to a deathless life to guard the book. I don't care what happens to you or anyone else, but I protect the book. That is my charge."
The book. She was struggling to understand. She felt drunker the more she heard.
"What you call the Grimmery. It has other names. No matter."
"Then why don't you take it? Why don't you have it?"
"I don't work like that. I am the silent partner. I work through events. I live on the sidelines. I dabble in causes and effects. I watch how the misbegotten creatures of this world live their lives. I interfere only to keep the book safe. To some extent, I can see what's coming, and to that extent, I meddle in the affairs of men and beasts."
He jigged like a little fiend.
"You see me here, you see me there. Having second sight is a great advantage in the security business."
"You work with Yackel?"
"We sometimes have the same intentions, and we sometimes do not. Her interest seems to be different from mine."
"Who is she? What is her interest? Why do you hover at the edges of my life?"
"In the world I come from, there are guardian angels," said the dwarf. "But so far as I can work it out, she is an opposite number, and her concern is you."
"Why do I deserve such a fiend? Why is my life so plagued? Who positioned her to influence my life?"
"There are things I don't know and things I do," said the dwarf. "Who Yackel answers to, if anyone, if anything, is beyond my realm of knowledge or interest. But why you? You must know this." "For you," the dwarf spoke in a bright offhand tone, "are neither this nor that. Or shall I say both this and that? Both of Oz and of the other world. Your old Frex always was wrong. You were never a punishment for his crimes. You are a half-breed. You are a new breed. You are a grafted limb. You are a dangerous anomaly. Always you were drawn to the composite creatures, the broken and reassembled, for that is what you are. Can you be so dull that you have not figured this out?
Show me something, she said. I do not know what you mean. Show me something the world hasn't shown me yet.
For you, a pleasure.
He disappeared, and there was the sound of mechanical parts being wound up, moving against one another, the grind of lubricated gears, the slap of leather belts, the chuck-chuck of pendulums swinging.
A private audience with the Time Dragon itself.
At the top, a beast prowled, flexing its wings in a dance of gestures, both bidding welcome and holding at bay. The witch stared. A small area halfway up was illuminated.
A three-act play, came the voice of the dwarf from deep within. Act One, the birth of holiness.
Later, she could not have said how she knew what it was, but what she saw, in an abbreviated pantomime, was the life of St. Aelphaba, the good woman, the mystic and recluse, who disappeared to pray behind a waterfall. The witch flinched to see the saint walk straight through the waterfall. A guttering spout overhead drained real water out into a hidden tray below. She waited for the TikTok saint to come out, but she didn't come, and eventually the lights went out.
Act Two, the birth of evil.
Wait, the saint didn't emerge as the tales say she did, said the witch. I want my money's worth or not at all, please.
Act Two, the birth of evil.
Lights came up on another little stage. There was a credible likeness of Colwyn Grounds, painted on a cardboard backdrop beyond. A figurine, who was Melina, kissed her parents goodbye and went off with Frex, a handsome little puppet with a short black beard and a jaunty step. They stopped in a small hut, and Frex kissed her and continued on to preach. All through the rest of the scene, he was off to one side, yammering away to some peasants, who were busy screwing each other on the ground before him, hacking each other to pieces and eating their sexual parts, which ran with a real gravy. You could smell the garlic and sautéed mushrooms. Melina, at home, yawned and waited and teased her pretty hair. Along came a man whom the witch could not identify at first. He had a small black bag, and from it he extracted a green glass bottle. He gave it to Melina to drink, and when she had, she fell into his arms, either stupefied and drunk, as the witch was tonight, or liberated. It wasn't clear. The traveller and Melina made love in the same bouncy rhythm as Frex's parishioners. Frex started to dance to the rhythm himself. Then, when the act of love was done, the traveller pulled himself off Melina. He snapped his fingers, and a balloon with a basket beneath descended from the fly space above. The traveller got in. It was the wizard.
"Oh, nonsense," said the witch. "This is pure poppycock."
The lights dimmed. The voice of the dwarf sounded from inside the contraption.
"Act Three," he said. "The marriage of the sacred and the wicked."
She waited, but no area was illuminated. No puppet moved.
"Well," she said.
"Well, what?" he answered.
"Where's the end of the play?"
He stuck his head out of a trap door and winked at her.
"Who said the end was written yet?" he answered.
and slammed the door shut.
Another door opened just by the witch's hand, and a tray slid out. Lying on it was an oval looking-glass, cracked along one side, scratched on its surfaces. It looked like the glass she had had since childhood, the one she used to imagine she could see the other land in, back when she believed in such a thing. The last she remembered of the oval glass was in her hideaway digs in the Emerald City. Inside the glass lived reflections of a young and beautiful Fiero and a young and impassioned Fay. The witch took the mirror and hid it in her apron and wandered away. There was nothing in the morning papers about the death of Madame Morrible. The witch, with a treacherous headache, decided that she could wait no longer. Either Averick and his beastly companions would spread the rumors, or they wouldn't. There was nothing left to be done. "Just let word get to the wizard, though," said the witch to herself. "I would like to be a fly on the wall of his bunker when that happens. Let him think I killed her. Let that be how the news goes." She returned to Munchkinland in a punishing journey, exhausting herself. She had slept so little, and her head still throbbed. But she was proud of herself. She arrived in the front yard of Bock Cottage and called for the family to come. Bock was out in the field, and one of his children had to be dispatched to fetch him. When he came running, he had an adze in one hand. "I wasn't expecting you. It took me a minute," he said, panting. "You'd have run quicker if you'd left your blade behind," she noted. But he didn't drop it. "Elfie, why have you come back?" "To tell you what I have done," she said. "I thought you would like to know. I have killed Madame Morrible, and she can no longer harm anyone." But Bock did not look pleased. "You took against that old woman," he said. "Surely she was beyond the point of hurting anyone now." "You've made the mistake that everyone makes," said the witch, cruelly disappointed. "Don't you know there is no such point?" "You had worked to protect the animals," said Bock, "but you did not intend to sink to the level of those who brutalized them." "I have fought fire with fire," said the witch, "and I ought to have done it sooner. Bock, you've become an equivocating fool." "Children," said Bock, "run inside and find your mother." He was scared of her. "You're sitting on the fence," she said. "Here your precious Munchkin land is going to be sucked back into the folds of Royal Oz under His Highness the Emperor Wizard. And you see what Glinda is up to, and you send that child on her way with the shoes that belong to me. You took a stand when you were young, Bock. How can you have spoiled so?" "Elfie," said Bock, "look at me. You are beside yourself. Have you been drinking? Dorothy is just a child. You may not retell this to make her into some sort of fiend." Miller, alerted to the tension in the front yard, came out and stood behind Bock. She carried a kitchen knife. Whispering noisily, the children watched from the window. "You do not need to defend yourselves with knives and adzes," said the witch coldly. "I had thought you would care to know about Madame Morrible." "You are shaking," said Bock. "Look, I will put down this thing. Clearly you are upset. Nessa's death has been hard on you. But you must get control of yourself, Elfie. Don't take against Dorothy. She is an innocent creature. She's all alone. I beg of you." "Oh, don't beg, don't beg," said the witch. "I could not abide begging from you, of all people." She ground her teeth and clenched her fists. "I will promise you nothing, Bock." and this time she got on her broom and flew away. Recklessly, she mounted the sides of air currents until the ground below had lost any detail sharp enough to cause her pain. She was beginning to feel too long away from Kiamo Ko. Lear was an idiot, headstrong and lily-livered by turns, and Nanny sometimes forgot where she was. The witch didn't want to think about yesterday, the death of Madame Morrible, the accusations made by the puppet play. She could hardly be more averse to the wizard than she already was. If there was a shred of possibility to that sick idea of his having fathered her, it only made her hate him the more. She would ask Nanny about it when she got home. When she got home. She was 38, and just realizing what it felt like to have a sense of home. For that, Sarima, thank you, she thought. Maybe the definition of home is the place where you are never forgiven, so you may always belong there, bound by guilt. And maybe the cost of belonging is worth it. But she decided to head toward Kiamo Ko by following the yellow brick road. She would make one last try for the shoes. She had nothing left to lose. If the shoes fell into the hands of the wizard, he would use them to bolster his claim to Munchkin Land. Maybe, if she tried, she could shrug her shoulders and leave Munchkin Land to its own fate. But damn it, the shoes were hers. She finally found a peddler who had seen Dorothy. He stopped by the side of his wagon and rubbed the ears of his donkey as he discussed it with her. "She passed here a few hours ago," he said, chewing on a carrot and sharing it with the donkey. "No, she wasn't alone. She had a ragamuffin crew of friends with her. Bodyguards, I suspect." "Oh, the poor frightened thing," said the witch. "Who? Munchkinlander beefcake boys, I wonder?" "Not exactly," said the peddler. "There was a straw man, and a tin woodman, and a big cat who hid in the bushes when I passed, a leopard, maybe, or a cougar." "A man of straw?" said the witch. "She's awakening the figures of myth. She's charming them to life. This must be some attractive child. Did you notice her shoes?" "I wanted to buy them from her." "Yes, yes, did you?" "Not for sale. She seemed very attached to them. They were given her by a good witch." "Pig spittle they were." "None of my affair, either way," said the peddler. "Can I interest you in anything?" "An umbrella," said the witch. "I've come out without one, and it looks nasty."
"I remember the good old days of the drought," said the peddler, fishing out a somewhat worn umbrella. "Ah! Here's the bumbershoot. Yours for a nickel florin."
"Mine for free," said the witch. "You wouldn't deny a poor old woman in need, would you, my friend?"
"Not and live to tell about it, I see," he answered, and went on his way uncompensated.
But as the wagon passed, the witch heard another voice.
"Of course, no one asks a beast of burden, but it's my opinion she's Ozma come out of the deep sleep chamber and marching on Oz to restore herself to the throne." "I hate royalists," said the peddler, and lashed out with a crop. "I hate animals with attitude."
But the witch could not stop to intervene. So far, she had been unable to save Nor. She had been incompetent at bargaining with the wizard. She had been a moment too late to murder Madame Morrible, or had she been just in time? Either way, she should not try what was clearly beyond her. The witch trembled on the lip of an updraft. She had brought the broom higher than ever before. She was in a state of exhilaration and panic. Should she pursue Dorothy? Should she snatch those shoes away? And what were her real motives? Was it to keep them out of the hands of the wizard, just as Glinda had wanted them out of the hands of power-hungry Munchkinlanders? Or was it to snatch back some small shred of Frex's attention, whether she had ever deserved it or not? Beneath the broom, clouds began to gauze the view of rock-freckled hills and patchwork meadows of melon and corn. The thin twists of vapor looked like the marks of erasure made by a schoolchild's rubber, streaking whitely along a watercolor sketch of a landscape. What if she should just keep on, urging the broom higher, yanking it up? Would it splinter as it beat itself against the heavens? She could give up these efforts. She could forsake Nor. She could release Lear. She could abandon Nanny. She could surrender Dorothy. She could give up the shoes. But a wind came up, a shoulder of hard air leaning onto her left side. She could not force the broom against it. She was driven sideways and down, until the yellow brick road once again etched a golden thread between forests and fields. There was a storm on the horizon, slotting bars of brownish rain between lavender-gray clouds and gray-green fields. She hadn't much time. Then she thought she caught sight of them below, and dove down to see. Were they stopping to rest beneath a black willow tree? If so, she could finish things up now. By the time the storm lifted and the witch awoke from what she now identified as a horrible hangover, she wasn't sure it was the same day. She wasn't even sure she had gotten near them. Could she have let them slip through her fingers like that? But whatever the case, delusion or foggy memory, the witch didn't dare follow them into the Emerald City. Madame Morrible had many friends in this rotten regime, and the news would have gotten through by now. There might even be search parties out for the witch. So be it. Though it galled her, for the time being, she had to give up on the idea of reclaiming Nessa's shoes. She scarcely rested during the entire trip back to Kiamo Ko, except to stop and pick some berries and nibble some nuts and sweet roots to keep her strength up. The castle had not been burned down. The wizard's reconnaissance army was still camped at its outpost near Red Windmill, in a state of bored readiness. Nanny was busy crocheting a pretty casket cover for her own funeral, and making guest lists. Most of the guests were already in the other land, presuming that for Nanny there was an other land. "How nice it would be to see Amma clutch again, I quite agree," shouted the witch, giving Nanny's shoulders a squeeze. "I always liked her. She had more character than that simpering Glinda."
"You were devoted to Glinda, you were," said Nanny. "Everyone knew it."
"Well, no more," said the witch.
"The traitor! "You smell of blood. Go wash up," said Nanny. "Is it your time?"
"I never wash, you know that. Where's Lear?"
"Who?"
"Lear."
"Oh, around somewhere," she smiled. "Look in the fish well."
By now an old family joke.
"What new nonsense is this?" said the witch, finding Lear in the music room.
"They were right all along," he said. "Look what I finally caught. After all these years." It was the golden carp that had long haunted the fish well. "Oh, I admit that it was dead, and I brought it up with the bucket, not a hook or a net. But even so, do you think we'll ever be able to tell them we finally caught it?" All these last months he had begun to talk about Sarima and the family as if they were ghosts, hiding just around the curve of the spiral staircase in the tower, suppressing giggles at this long, long game of hide-and-seek. "We can only hope so," she said. She wondered faintly if it was immoral to raise children in the habit of hope. Was it not, in the end, all the harder for them to adjust to the reality of how the world worked? "Everything else was all right while I was gone?" "Just fine," he said. "But I'm glad you're back." She grunted and went to greet Chistery and the chattering kin. In her room, she hung the old glass with a cord and a nail and kept from looking at it. She had the horrible feeling that she would see Dorothy, and she didn't want to see her again. The child reminded her of someone. It was that unquestioning directness, that gaze unblinkered by shame. She was as natural as a raccoon, or a fern, or a comet. The witch thought, "Is it Nor? Is it that Dorothy reminds me of how Nor was at this age?" But back then, the witch had not cared for Nor, not really, even though her face had been a small, velvet reworking of Fiero's. Except for Nessa Rose and Shell, the witch had never warmed to the glowing promise of children. She had always felt more alone in this regard than in her color. No. And now her glance did fall on the tired old-looking glass, despite her intentions. She thought, the witch with her mirror. Who do we ever see but ourselves? And that's the curse. Dorothy reminds me of myself at that age, whatever it is. The time in Uvels. There is the green girl, shy, gawky, and humiliated. To avoid the pain of damp feet, splashing around in clammy leggings made of swamp calf hide and waterproof boots. Mama, pregnant with Shell, huge as a barge. Mama praying non-stop for months that she might at last bring a healthy child into the world. Mama dumping the bottles of liquor and the pinlobble leaves into the mud. Nanny tends to little Nessa, papoosing her around in the daily hunt for charfish, needle flowers, and broad bean vines. Nessa can see, but she cannot touch. What a curse for a child! No wonder she believed in things she couldn't see. Nothing is provable by touch. For his atonement, Papa takes the green girl with him on an expedition to the relatives of Turtleheart, a many-branched family living in a nest of huts and walkways suspended in a grove of broad, rotting, supple trees. The quadlings, who are more comfortable on their haunches, duck their heads. The smell of raw fish in their homes, on their skin. They are frightened of the Unionist minister, finding them out in their squalid hamlet. I have no firm memory of individuals, but for one old matriarch, toothless and proud. The quadlings come up after a period of shyness, not to the minister but to me, the green girl. She is no longer I. She is too long ago. She is only she, impenetrably mysterious and dense. She stands as Dorothy stood, some inborn courage making her spine straight, her eyes unblinking, her shoulders back, her hands at her side, submissive to the stroke of their fingers on her face, unflinching in the cause of missionary work. Papa asks forgiveness for the death of Turtleheart, maybe some 5 years earlier. He says it is his fault. He and his wife have both fallen in love with the quaddling glassblower. "What can I give you to make up for it?" he says. Elphaba, the girl, thinks he is mad. She thinks they are not listening. They are mesmerized by her weirdness. "Please forgive me," he says. The matriarch alone responds to these words. Maybe she is the only one who actually remembers Turtleheart. She has a look of someone caught venturing out from beneath a rock. Well, in a people whose moral code is so lax, so little is wrong. For her, this encounter is a mysterious, complicated transaction. She says something like, We don't shrive, and not for Turtleheart, no. And she strikes Papa on the face with a reed, cutting him with thin stripes. I was only a witness. I was not really alive then, but I saw. This was when Papa began to lose his way. It dates from this whipping. I see him shocked. It doesn't occur in his conception of moral life that some sins are unforgivable. He blanches, onion white, behind the blood-pearled perforations of her attack. Maybe she has every right to do what she's done, but in Papa's life, she's become old Cambricia. I see her, willful, proud. Her moral system doesn't allow for forgiveness, and she is just as incarcerated as he, but she doesn't know it. She grins, all gums and menace, and rests the reed on her collarbone, where its fletching tip falls like a necklace around her own neck. He points to me and says, not to me, but to them all, "Isn't this punishment enough?" Elphaba the girl does not know how to see her father as a broken man. All she knows is that he passes his brokenness on to her. Daily his habits of loathing and self-loathing cripple her. Daily she loves him back because she knows no other way. I see myself there, the girl witness, wide-eyed as Dorothy, staring at a world too horrible to comprehend, believing, by dint of ignorance and innocence, that beneath this unbreakable contract of guilt and blame, there is always an older contract that may bind and release in a more salutary way, a more ancient precedent of ransom, that we may not always be tormented by our shame. Neither Dorothy nor young Elphaba can speak of this, but the belief of it is in both our faces. The witch had taken the green glass bottle, whose label still read Miracle ELI, and placed it on her bedside table. She took a spoonful of the ancient elixir before sleeping, hoping for miracles, seeking some version of the fabulous alibi Dorothy was unwinding, that she had come from a country somehow other, not the real states across the desert, but a whole separate geophysical existence, even metaphysical. The wizard made such a claim for himself, and if the dwarf was right, the witch had this ancestry too. At night she tried to train herself to look on the periphery of her dreams, to note the details. It was a little like trying to see around the edges of a mirror, but she found more rewarding. But what did she get? Everything flickered, like a guttering candle, but more harshly, more stridently. People moved in short, jerky motions. They were colorless, they were vapid, they were drugged, they were manic. Buildings were high and cruel, winds were strong. The wizard stepped in and out of these pictures, a very humble-looking man in this context. In one window, in a shop from which the wizard was emerging, rather dejectedly, she thought, she caught some words once, and willed herself with tremendous effort to wake up so she could write them down. But they didn't make any sense to her. No Irish need apply. Then one night she had a nightmare. Again the wizard began it. He walked over some hills of sand, with tall gray grasses blowing in a fierce gale, 1,000,000 grasses like the scratchy sedge with which the old quaddling matriarch had struck Frex, and the wizard stopped along a broad, flat stretch. He stepped out of his clothes and looked at a timepiece in his hands, as if memorizing an historic instant. Then he walked forward, naked and broken. When the witch realized what he was approaching. She tried to back out of the dream with a howl, but could not manage to disengage herself. This was the mythical ocean, and the wizard walked into water up to his knees, his thighs, his waist. He paused and shivered, and slopped water over the rest of himself as a kind of penance. Then he kept walking, and disappeared entirely into the sea, as Saint Elphaba of the waterfall had disappeared behind her watery veil. The sea rocked like an earthquake, vomiting against the sandy shore, pounding in a kettle-drum commotion. There was no other side to it. It threw the wizard back again and again, though again and again he forged in, more and more exhausted. The stoicism, the determination. No wonder he had managed to overcome a nation. The dream ended with him washed back on shore one last time, weeping with frustration. She woke, gagging, terrified beyond telling, salt in her nostrils. Thereafter she avoided the miracle elixir. Instead, she concocted a potion derived both from Nanny's recipe book and the Grimmery's marginalia on how to keep awake. If she fell asleep again, she would be prey to that vision of earthly destruction, and she would rather die. Nanny didn't have very much to say about nightmares.
"Your mother had them, too," she remarked at last. "She used to say she saw the unknown city of anger in her dreams. She was so enraged over how you turned out, you know. I mean physically, dear. Don't look like that at me. A green girl isn't easy for any mother to explain away. That she gulped down those pills like candy when Nessa Rose was expected. If Nessa Rose were still around to take up a grudge, she could blame you, in a way, for what happened to her." "But where did you get that green bottle?" said the witch into Nanny's good ear. "Look at it, Nanny dear, and try to remember. I suspect I bought it at a jumble sale," she said. "I could stretch a penny, believe me."
"You could stretch the truth even further," thought the witch. She suppressed a desire to smash the green glass. "How deeply bound by cords of family anger we all are," thought the witch. "None of us breaks free." One afternoon, a few weeks later, Lear came back from a ramble all hot and bothered. The witch hated to hear that he had been hobnobbing again with the wizard's soldiers down in Red Windmill. "They had news. A dispatch from the Emerald City," he said. "A delegation of strangers got in to see the wizard, and just a girl. Dorothy, they said, a girl from the other land, and some friends. The wizard hasn't allowed an audience with his subjects in years. He works through ministers, they say. A lot of soldiers think he died long ago, and it's a palace plot to safeguard the peace. But Dorothy and her friends got in, and they saw him and told everyone what it was like." "Well, well," said the witch, "imagine that. All of Oz, loyal and otherwise, is yapping about this Dorothy. What did the fools say next?" "The dispatch soldier said that the guests asked the wizard to grant them some wishes. The Scarecrow asked for a brain, Nick Chopper the Tin Woodman asked for a heart, and the Cowardly Lion asked for courage. And I suppose Dorothy asked for a shoehorn. Dorothy asked to be sent home. I hope she gets her wish. And—" But Lear got coy. "Oh, come on. I'm too old to be put off my supper by gossip," she snapped. Lear looked flushed with guilty pleasure. "The soldiers said that the wizard had rejected the odd requests." "And you're so very surprised?" "The wizard told Dorothy that he would grant them their wishes when they had... when they had... You haven't stuttered in years. Don't start again or I'll beat you." Dorothy and his friends have to come here and kill you," he finished. "The soldiers said it's because you murdered an old lady in Shiz, a famous old lady, and you're an assassin. Also, you're crazy," they said. "I'm a more likely murderer than those incompetent vagabonds could be," she said. "He was just trying to get rid of them. Probably he's instructed his own gale forces to slit the girl's throat as soon as she's safely out of the limelight." And no doubt the wizard had confiscated the shoes. It galled her. But how flattered she felt that the news of her attack had gotten out. By now she was sure she had killed Madame Morrible. It only made sense that she had. But Lear shook his head. "The funny thing," he said, "is that Dorothy is called Dorothy Gale. The soldiers at Red Windmill said the Gale forces wouldn't touch her. They're too superstitious." "What do these soldiers know of intrigue stationed here, out at the edge of the moon?" Lear shrugged. "Aren't you impressed that the Wizard of Oz even knows who you are? Are you a murderer?" "Oh, Lear, you'll understand when you're older. Or anyway, not understanding will become second nature, and it won't matter. I wouldn't harm you, if that's what you mean. But you sound so surprised that I should be known in the Emerald City. Just because you disobey me and treat me like refuse, do you think the whole world does?" Yet she was pleased. "But you know, Lear, if there's even the slightest chance that there's any truth to these rumors, you had better stay away from Red Windmill for a while. They might kidnap you and hold you for ransom until I give myself up to this schoolgirl and her needy companions." "I want to meet Dorothy," he said. "You're not that age already. Please preserve us," she said. "I always intended to pickle you before you got to puberty." "Well, I'm not getting kidnapped, so don't worry," he said. "Besides, I want to be here when they get here." "Worry is the last thing I'd do if you got kidnapped," she answered. "It'd be your own damn fault, and a great relief to me to have one less mouth to feed." "Oh, well, then, who'd carry the firewood up all those stairs every winter?" "I'll hire that Nick Chopper fellow. His axe looks pretty sharp to me." "You've seen him?" Lear's mouth dropped open. "No, you haven't." "I have, as a matter of fact," she said. "Who says I don't travel in the best circles?" "What's she like?" he said, his face eager and bright. "You must have seen Dorothy, too. What's she like, Auntie Witch?" "Don't you auntie me? You know that makes me sick." He pestered without stopping until finally she had to screech at him. "She's a beautiful little dolt who believes everything everybody says to her. And if she gets here and you tell her you love her, she'll probably believe you. Now get out of here. I have work to do." He lingered at the door and said, "The lion wants courage, the tin man a heart, and the scarecrow brains. Dorothy wants to go home. What do you want?"
"A little peace and quiet."
"No, really."
She couldn't say forgiveness, not to Lear. She started to say a soldier to make fun of his mooning affections over the guys in uniform. But realizing, even as she said it, that he would be hurt, she caught herself halfway, and in the end, what came out of her mouth surprised them both. She said, "A soul." He blinked at her.
"And you?" she said, in a quieter voice. "What do you want, Lear, if the wizard could give you anything?"
"A father," he answered. She wondered briefly if she was going insane. That night she sat up in a chair and thought about what she had said. A person who doesn't believe in the unnamed God or anything else can't believe in a soul.
If you could take the skewers of religion, those that riddle your frame, make you aware every time you move, if you could withdraw the scimitars of religion from your mental and moral systems, could you even stand? Or do you need religion as, say, the hippos in the grasslands need the poisonous little parasites within them to help them digest fiber and pulp? The history of peoples who have shucked off religion isn't an especially persuasive argument for living without it. Is religion itself, that tired and ironic phrase, the necessary evil? The idea of religion worked for Nessa Rose. It worked for Frex. There may be no real city in the clouds, but dreaming of it can enliven the spirit. Perhaps in our age's generous attempt at unionism, allowing all devotional urges, life and breath, under the canopy of the unnamed God, perhaps we have sealed our own doom. Perhaps it's time to name the unnamed God, even feebly and in our own wicked image, that we may at least survive under the illusion of an authority that could care for us. For whittle away from the unnamed God anything approximating character, and what have you got? A big hollow wind. And wind may have gale force, but it may not have moral force. And a voice in a whirlwind is a carnival barker's trick. More appealing, she now saw for once, the old-timers' notions of paganism. Lurlina in her fairy chariot, hovering just out of sight in the clouds, ready to swoop down some millennium or other and remember who we are. The unnamed God, by virtue of its anonymity, can't ever be suspected of a surprise visit. And would we recognize the unnamed God if it knocked on our doors? Sometimes she napped against her will, her chin sagging on her chest, sometimes driving right down to the tabletop, jarring her teeth and rattling her jaw, and startling herself awake. She had taken to standing at the window, looking down in the valley. It would be weeks before Dorothy and her band arrived, if indeed they hadn't already been murdered and their corpses burned, just as Serima's must have been. One night, Lear came back from a visit to the barracks. He was teary and inarticulate, and she tried not to care about it, but was too curious to let it go. Finally, he told her. One of the soldiers had proposed to his fellows that when Dorothy and friends arrive, the friends be killed and Dorothy be tied up for a little amusement among the lonely, randy men. "Oh, men will have their fantasies," said the witch. But she was troubled. What had made Lear cry was that his friends had reported the soldier's remarks to their superior. The soldier had been stripped and castrated and nailed to the windmill. His body rotated in circles as the vultures came and tried to peck at his entrails. He still wasn't even dead. "It isn't hard to find evil in this world," said the witch. "Evil is always more easily imagined than good, somehow." But she was struck at the vehemence of the commander's response against one of his own. So Dorothy might well be alive still, and was apparently under orders of protection from the highest military officers in the land. Lear held Chistery in his lap and sobbed onto his scalp. Chistery said, "Well, we'll wail while woe'll wheel." And he cried along with Lear. "Aren't they the sweet pair?" observed Nanny. "Wouldn't that make the sweetest painting?" Under cover of darkness, the witch slipped away on her broom and saw to it that the suffering soldier died at once. She thought one afternoon, inexplicably, of the baby lion cub taken from its mother and pressed into service in Dr. Nicodick's lab back in Shiz. She remembered how it had cowered. She remembered the fuss she had made about it. or was she only glorifying herself in hindsight? If it was the same lion, grown up timid and unnatural, it should have no bone to pick with her. She had saved it when it was young, hadn't she? They confused her, this band of yellow brick road irregulars. The Tin Woodman was hollow, a tick-tock cipher, or an eviscerated human under a spell. The lion was a perversion of its own natural instincts. She could deal with tick-tock clockworks. She could handle animals. But it was the scarecrow she feared. Was it a spell? Was it a mask? Was there merely some clever dancer inside? All three of them were emasculated in some way or other, deluded under the spell of the girl's innocence. She could give the lion a history, and think of him as that abused cub in a Shiz science hall. She suspected that Nick Chopper was the victim of her own sister's spite and magic, casualty of the enchanted axe. But she had no way to place the scarecrow. She began to think that behind that painted cornmeal sack of a face, there was a face she would know, a face she had been waiting for. She lit a candle and said the words aloud, as if she really could do spells. The words blew aside the taper of grayish smoke that rose from the fatty tallow. If they had any other effect in the world than that, she didn't know it yet. "Fiero didn't die," she said. "He was imprisoned, and he has escaped. He is coming home to Kiamo Ko. He is coming home to me. And he is disguised as a scarecrow, because he doesn't yet know what he will find." It would take brains to think up such a plan. She took an old tunic of Fiero's. She called elderly Killijoy and bade him sniff it well, and sent him down into the valley every day, so that if the travelers showed up, Killijoy would be able to find them and lead them home rejoicing. And though she tried not to sleep, on occasion she could not help it. Her dreams brought Fiero closer and closer to home. There was a day in the first gusts of autumn that the banners and standards of the camp below were shifted, and bugles blew tinnily up the slopes to the castle. By this the witch guessed that the troop had arrived in Red Windmill and were being given a royal welcome. "They've come so far, they won't wait now," she said. "Go, Killijoy, go find them and show them the quickest way here." She loosed the senior dog, and so strong were his exhortations that the entire pack of his kin went racing along with him, howling with joy and frantic to do their duty. "Nanny," cried the witch, "put on a clean petticoat and change your apron. We'll have company by nightfall." But the dogs didn't come back, all afternoon and into the gloaming, and the witch could see why. With a telescopic eye in a cylindrical casing, invented by the witch along the lines of Dr. Dillamon's discovery about opposing lenses, she followed a shock of carnage. Dorothy and the lion trembled with the scarecrow beyond, while the Tin Woodman struck the heads of her beasts one after the other with his axe. Killijoy and his wolfy relations lay scattered like dead soldiers on a field of retreat. The witch danced with rage and summoned Lear. "Your dog is dead. Look what they did," she cried. "Look and make sure that I didn't only imagine it."
"Well, I didn't like that dog very much any more," said Lear. "He had a good long life, anyway."
He concurred tremblingly, but then trained the glass on the slope again.
"You fool! That Dorothy is not for messing with," she cried, slapping the instrument out of his hand.
"You're awfully on edge for someone about to have company," he said sullenly. "They are supposed to be coming to kill me, if you remember," she said, although she had forgotten that, as she had forgotten her desire for the shoes until she saw them again in the glass. The wizard had not demanded them of Dorothy. Why not? What fresh campaign of intrigue was this? She wheeled about her room, whipping pages of the grimoire back and forth. She recited a spell, did it wrong, did it again, and then turned and tried to apply it to the crows. Though the original three crows had long since fallen stiffly from the top of the door frame, there were plenty of others in residence still, rather inbred and silly, but suggestible in a stupid mob-like way. "Go," she said. "Look with your eyes more closely than I can. Pull the mask off the scarecrow so we can know who he is. Get them for me. Peck out the eyes of Dorothy and the lion. And three of you go on ahead to the old Princess Nastoya out there in the thousand-year grasslands. For the time is coming when we will be reunited, all of us. With the help of the Grimoire, the wizard may topple at last." "I never know what you're talking about anymore," said Lear. "You can't blind them." "Oh, watch me," snarled the witch. The crows blew away in a black cloud and dropped like buckshot through the sky, down the jagged precipices, until they came to the travelers. "A pretty sunset, is there?" said Nanny, coming up to the witch's room in one of her rare forays, Chistery, as always, providing service. "She sent the crows out to blind the guests coming for dinner."
"What?"
"She's blinding the guests coming for dinner."
"Well, that's one way to avoid having to dust, I suppose."
"Will you lunatics hush up?" The witch was twitching as if with a nervous disorder. Her elbows flapped, as if she were a crow herself. She gave out a long howl when she found them in the glass. "What? What? Let me see," said Lear, grabbing the thing. He explained to Nanny, because the witch was almost beyond speech by now. "Well, I guess the scarecrow knows how to scare crows, all right."
"Why? What's he done?"
"They're not coming back, that's all I'll say," said Lear, glancing at the witch.
"It still could be him," she said at last, breathing heavily. "You might get your wish yet, Lear."
"My wish?" He didn't remember asking for a father, and she didn't bother to remind him. Nothing had yet suggested to her that the scarecrow wasn't a man in disguise. She would not need forgiveness if Fiero had not died. The light was failing, and the odd band of friends was making good time up the hill. They had come without an escort of soldiers, perhaps because the soldiers really believed that Kiamo Ko was run by a wicked witch.
"Come on, bees," said the witch. "Work with me now. All together on this one, honeys. We need a little sting. We need a little zip. We want a little nasty. Can you give us a little jab? No, not us. Listen when I talk to you, you simpletons. The girl on the hill below, she's after your queen bee. And when you're through with your job, I'll go down and collect those shoes." "What's that old hag blathering about now?" said Nanny to Lear.
The bees were alert to the pitch in the witch's voice, and they rose to swarm out the window.
"You watch. I can't look," said the witch. "The moon is just like a pretty peach rising over the mountains," said Nanny, with the telescope to her old cataracted eye. "Why don't we put in some peach trees instead of all those infernal apples in the back?" "The bees, Nanny! Lear, take that from her and tell me what happens."
Lear gave a blow-by-blow recounting.
"They're swooping down. They look like a genie or something, all flying in a big clump with a straggly tail. The travelers see them coming. Yes, yes, The Scarecrow is taking straw out of his chest and leggings and covering the lion and Dorothy. And there's a little dog, too, so the bees can't get through the straw, and the Scarecrow is all in pieces on the ground.